Greetings, greetings once again to all my enemies and all my friends. You may have heard the news, but stand by now for the worldview. That's right. It's the Weekly Worldview. It's the show where we don't take calls. We don't tolerate sponsors. But we do help focus you on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. It's so good to have everyone here. Should we dive right in, or should I go for the cold bug? There's a cold bug sweeping through the McBurney compound. It swept through all last week. And various members of the McBurney family, we succumbed to at various levels. But everybody got it. It wasn't that bad. It was just a little cold bug, and you know. So anyway, we're feeling fine today. As a matter of fact, we're back. Yes, it's back to old times. Back when you just had a cold bug go through that. That's all. That's all it was. Meanwhile, from the justice file, Rand Paul, senator from Kentucky, has sent a criminal referral to the Department of Justice accusing Anthony Fauci about lying. That's right. According to the Washington Examiner, Senator Rand Paul requested that Attorney General Merrick Garland criminally investigate Anthony Fauci over Senate testimony where Fauci said he never funded gain-of-function research at the Wuhan lab for virology. Never, never, not once. I never did it. We never did that. I don't even know what that is. Gain of what? Huh? Let me turn up my hearing aid. What? Gain of? Ah, I never heard of it. So anyway, Rand Paul catching Anthony Fauci in a very obvious lie. Very obvious if you got to watch the testimony. It was something to watch. Anthony Fauci basically denying what his own department had written regarding the funding of research at the Wuhan Lab of Virology. It was EcoHealth. It wasn't NIH. It was DHS, LSMFT. So anyway, Rand Paul, note to Rand, asking Attorney General Merrick Garland to criminally investigate Anthony Fauci is like asking Tom Hagen to investigate Don Corleone. Yes. Well, I mean, except that the consigliere, he at least had a code of honor that he was bound to keep up. Merrick Garland is bound only by his allegiance to the global Marxist insurrection. So he's willing to lie and tell the big lie. So I wouldn't hold out much hope that Merrick Garland criminally investigates Anthony Fauci, unless it becomes politically advantageous for the global Marxist insurrection to throw Anthony Fauci under the bus. And of course, you never know when that's going to happen. Because one thing about the communists is they end up eating their own. And that reminds me of an interaction I had on Facebook with, I don't know who he is yet because he won't say. But basically, it was around the women's soccer team, the Team America soccer, female. How do you say it? The women's soccer team for the Olympics. Basically, taking a knee or disrespecting the flag or whatever it was. A friend of mine posted up a photo that was actually cobbled together by Dinesh D'Souza. It showed the female soccer stars taking a knee. And he said, this is despicable to see this at the Olympics. At which one point someone posted up, hey, that picture wasn't taken at the Olympics. You need to fact check this. So whenever someone uses the word fact check, I assume they're a leftist. Yes, that's what I assume. Because fact checking has become a weapon against the truth by the leftists. So I typed in, hey, maybe we need to do some research. I'll find out where this picture was taken. But what do you say about people taking the knee during the national anthem? At which point he equivocated. He wouldn't answer. He said, what is your end point? I said, my end point is to get you to state an unequivocal opinion. Me, personally, I condemn kneeling during the national anthem with extreme prejudice. That's what I put. That's my opinion. What say you? Now, as we went to air today, he still has not answered. It's just a bunch of mealy-mouthed stuff about, well, everybody has the right to peaceful protest. Anyway, so where was I going with that? Anyway, this whole Merrick Garland, the big lie, the big lie. So this guy on Facebook, he won't just come out and say whether he's for kneeling during the anthem, which is what he is, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure he's for it. But he won't come out and say it because he doesn't have to, because he's protected by the big lie that you don't have to state an unequivocal opinion and you'll be protected by the other liars all around you who will simply call the person who's asking you to tell the truth, they'll call him a racist, a radical. He's a racist. White supremacist is what he is. All right, so Rand, good luck. It is good for Rand Paul to make the statement that Mr. Fauci needs to be criminally investigated. That's a positive thing. It could amount to something were there to be a change of administration. And so that's all fine and well and good. But let's go now to the death penalty file, where the largest ransomware attack in history just occurred and almost nobody talked about it. Uh-huh. Miami-based, this is according to a story I pulled down from Newsmax. Miami-based Casiva shut down servers after an attack on July 2nd. The attack affected businesses in 17 countries and forced most of Sweden's supermarkets to shut down for several days because they're all dependent on this one company's IT technology. Well, now, Casiva says that it has obtained a decryption tool that is allowing it to unlock the networks for the approximately 1,500 businesses that are affected. Casiva did not disclose whether it had paid the hackers. They had demanded $70 million in Bitcoin. Casiva doesn't say whether or not they paid the ransom. They just say that we have a tool that is helping us unlock our networks again. Read that. Yes, they paid the ransom. That's the way I read it. Otherwise, they would have said, we didn't pay the ransom. We figured out another way. Or maybe you keep it quiet. I don't know. If you figure out the hackers, I guess you don't want to let them know. So I guess we don't know if they paid the ransom, but I'm going to assume they did because everyone else has. So until I hear differently, that's my assumption. Experts, according to Newsmax, experts believe this could be the biggest ransomware attack on record, which begs the question I opened with. How come you're only hearing about it on fringe right-wing outlets like this show and some of the fringe right-wing websites that I go to? Why wouldn't this be top news on the CBS Evening News? Well, it's interesting, isn't it? When crime, even crime, becomes political, because it's embarrassing for Joe Biden and for the Democrats and for the Marxist insurrectionists who've seized the levers of power and taken down the republic, it's embarrassing to them that a bunch of kids in their basement are holding companies hostage for millions of dollars. It's embarrassing, so let's not report on it. Why? Because we don't want to be embarrassed? Well, you're not going to be embarrassed while the whole country is taken from you. And you, who don't report it, you'll all see each other in the gulag, along with members of the Biden-Harris administration. And what's his name? The singer, the crooner, John Legend. You'll see him in the gulag. You'll all see each other in the gulag, and you'll be wondering, what happened? We went along. Everything was supposed to be okay. We went along to get along. And that's where you'll end up. Anyway, Joe Biden, by the way, speaking of the Biden-Harris administration, Joe Biden warned Vladimir Putin over this and other cyber attacks, and suggested Washington could take action. Huh? That's right. He'll pick up a chain, come after you, buddy. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I wonder if this company, what was it? Kaseya? Did I say Casiva earlier? It's Kaseya, K-A-S-E-Y-A. I wonder if Kaseya was one of the companies on the do not hack list that Joe gave to Vlad the last time they met.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Biden. I appreciate this list. I will pay very close attention. Thank you.
Well, I guess we'll find out. Now, we go from there into the bad government file. And for bad government, we go first to San Francisco, where they have a homeless problem. One of the problems is the homeless are rooting around in the city's garbage cans. That's right. They don't like that. They would prefer that the homeless depend on the government rather than searching for food in garbage cans. And so what's their solution? They're going to swap out the garbage cans with new high-tech, super secure garbage cans. That's right. Not only secure from raccoons, but also from homeless and old hippies, junkies and weirdos and creeps. The Public Works Department there in San Francisco has developed a program. That's right, they've got a program, and the program is to determine which sort of garbage cans will work best. And so the mayor and several of the governor's illegitimate nephews are all on the board of the program, I'm sure. And the program has come out with some hard numbers. That's right. They estimate that each bum-proof garbage can will cost between $12,000 and $20,000. That's right. So to replace 15 trash cans in downtown San Francisco will cost over $500,000. But it's okay because it'll drive the bums further into the arms of the government for their sustenance, which is the whole point. And really, can you put a price on that? Anyway, the $20,000, by the way, that's just for the outer shell, the bum-proof part. The inner bins, they'll have to be custom-made, and there's no estimate on that yet. But, you know, custom-made, you can that means expensive. Public Works Acting Director Alaric DeGraff. Alaric DeGraffenried. Now that sounds like he made that up. Is he in the witness protection program? Alaric DeGraffenried. Anyway, he's the acting director of public works, which means he's not the actual director. He's just acting like the director, but he's getting paid as if he were the director, and his decisions have the same weight as if he were the director. So in fact, you can take the word acting out. He's the director. Anyway, he says that these trash cans are going to be made here in San Francisco. And there's a lot of manual labor that goes into that cost. Maybe we should sign up the homeless to make them. Oh, no, wait. Then they wouldn't depend on us for their sustenance. Let's see. The new trash cans will also contain high-tech sensors that will let the department know when the trash can needs to be emptied. Now, that's a pretty cool idea. I like that. In the past, it's been the homeless have been the sensor that tells the department when the trash can needs to be emptied because, how could they tell? Because the garbage was all over the sidewalk because the bum was crawling through there. And then they knew they didn't have to empty the trash can. They knew they had to clean up the sidewalk and that the trash can itself would be mostly empty, at least partially. So that's the old school sensor. Was the homeless old drugged out hippie. Now they're going to go to high-tech electronic sensors, which actually sounds pretty cool. Anyway, you may ask, says PJ Media, why this large expenditure for garbage cans? Well, because they already had bum-proof garbage cans that they invested tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in the past. But the bums figured out how to pick the locks. Dumb. Hey, just because I'm a bum, it doesn't mean I'm a complete moron. I can figure out how to pick a lock that was meant to stop a raccoon. So the bums pick the locks, they dump the can on the street, and then sort through the garbage and take what they want. And then they leave the other garbage, the lesser of the garbage. It's the worst garbage there is. I mean, a bum doesn't even want it. And they leave that on the sidewalk. That's according to Alaric DeGraffenried, the acting director up there. All right. So what's a liberal to do? You can't solve the homeless problem. by eliminating welfare and encouraging people to go to work. Let people get hungry until they go to work. That's, no, we can't have that. No, we're going to have $50,000 trash cans, $20,000 for the outer shell, and then we got to custom make the inner bin, and then we forever have a research program for the mayor's illegitimate stepson so that he can keep up with the technology race between bum and trash receptacle. Reach through the outer shell. Bend your elbow just right into the inner bin, Alaric. You might find the remains of a pork street taco that are really good. And the rest, you just leave it in the bin. Don't give up. Try again, Alaric. You can do it. All right. So from there, we go to the Marxist insurrection file. That's right, a pork street taco. If it's up there above the rim, and you can get your hand in there. The Marxist insurrection file. We go to Cleveland, Ohio, where the Cleveland Indians have officially changed their name to the Cleveland Guardians. Same number of syllables, so that all the old songs they have will be, "We are the Indians, we are the Guardians." That's why they had to go with the same. There you have it. They're no longer the Cleveland Indians. And so in response, it's a baseball thing. I love baseball, by the way. I used to love baseball. Not really so much anymore. The Society for American Baseball Research wants to introduce us all to Sakalexis. What's his name here? I'm sorry. I have to get his whole name. Sakalexis. Now, I missed his first name. That was pretty bad preparation on my part because I don't have his first name. Anyway, here it is. Louis Sakalexis was recruited by the Cleveland Spiders. That was the forerunner of the Cleveland Indians. Louis Sakalexis played for the Cleveland Spiders from 1890 to 1899. He was a member of the Penobscot tribe of Native Americans, and he quickly ascended to stardom, earning the team the nickname Indians. That's how good he was. They called the whole team Indians because they had one really good Indian on the team. Anyway, Sakalexis wowed local sports writers who began referring to the team as the Indians in the late 1890s. That's right, a headline in the Cleveland Plain Dealer referred to the team as Taboo's Indians, a reference to both Louis Sakalexis, the star, and the team's manager, Patsy Taboo. On March 27, 1897, the Cleveland Plain Dealer reported, quote, "The Indians have a spring schedule that's bound to give them good hard work," unquote. That was in the newspaper in 1897. And not long after that, the name of the team was changed from the Spiders to the Indians. Now, while some historians claim that the owner eventually officially chose the name Indians to mimic the Atlanta Braves because they had won the World Series a year earlier, some claim that. Some claim it was just a reference to the slow morphing of the name into the Indians. Anyway, the name, according to Breitbart, the name Cleveland Indians is nonetheless the stark revival of the team's old byname. And folks, no matter which history is applicable, no matter what the reason was that the owner officially changed the name to the Indians, no matter which history applies, the Marxist socialists and the iconoclasts hell-bent on destroying history, they would erase either any or all history, whether it was the Spiders, whether it was Louis Sakalexis, whether it was the Atlanta Braves, they would erase all of them. They will, if allowed to continue to rampage, they will erase all of the various stories of our past. We won't even be able to argue about whether or not it was the Atlanta Braves or Louis Sakalexis. Why did they become the Indians? You won't even be allowed to say, you won't even be allowed to express an opinion about the past, because the past will be erased for all intents and purposes. And it only takes a generation. And they've been at it for 10 years, at least that I'm aware of. All right, so the Cleveland Guardians, all right. From there, we go to reason number 1,208 to get or keep your children out of the government schools. We go to Coach Joe Kennedy, who is a veteran of the United States Marine Corps, who spent 20 years defending the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. He was fired by his government school district where he worked, and he was told upon his firing in writing that he could not bow his head, clasp his hands, or anything that appears to be prayer on the field. That's what they had told him in writing before they fired him for doing something like one of those things. This past week, a court of appeals declined to rehear his case, leaving the previous ruling in place, which stated that the Bremerton Government School District did not violate his religious and free speech rights when they told him not to pray on the football field. So does that even, I can't even comprehend how do you not violate someone's religious rights when you tell him he can't pray? That by definition would be a violation of, no, not anymore. No, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because the Bill of Rights is not, it's just passé. It's white supremacist. It's structurally racist. It has to be torn down. And there are enough people in the judiciary who believe that we are on the precipice of a very, very catastrophic events. They've corrupted enough of the system that, how could this ruling stand? Anyway, you take it to the Supreme Court, and I just don't have any confidence anymore, that's all. It's like Rand Paul with his criminal referral. Nah, okay, do you think that really means much at this point? I mean, they've stolen the government. They've stolen the republic. They've stolen the nation nakedly in front of God and everybody. You think you're going to take them to court over that? I don't think so. I don't have a lot of confidence, that's all. But you people know me. I'm much too pessimistic in general. So instead, let's move on. Instead of lamenting the end of free speech and freedom of religion and all the Ten Amendments and whatever, let's not get caught up in being nostalgic for all of that stuff. Come on now. It's a brave new world. We'll go instead to reason number 1,209. To get or keep your children out of the government schools, former assistant principal Rachel Damiano and former science teacher Katie Madar have been terminated. Terminated, I said, by their government school board. Why? They created a movement called I Resolve. It's called the I Resolve Movement, and it was set up to resist LGBTQ legislation and all of that queer, deviant, perverted stuff that they're putting on the kids in public schools. These two public school employees started a movement against it. The problem is, in at least one instance, they used their school email address to exchange messages against the molestation and queering of the children in their schools. And so now they've been fired for using school resources against the school. The school's intent is to queer and molest the kids. The teachers tried to stop that. They used their school email address. Hence, they've been fired.
Public school teachers.
What's that now? Well, it's probably the best thing that could have ever happened to these two is to get fired out of the government school system. Because obviously they don't fit. I mean, if they're uncomfortable with queering and molesting and transing children, then they don't belong in the government schools. Because that's the mission of the government schools, to corrupt and molest and pervert and trans and queer kids. Yeah, they might accidentally teach them how to spell and do a little bit of math, but the main goal, the main mission, is the queering and the transing and the molestation. That's what it's all about. Anyway, the iResolve movement proposes that individuals use anatomically correct bathrooms. Boy, that's pretty controversial. They also oppose the requirement that teachers use students' preferred pronouns. Okay, they obviously do not fit in with the program in the government school, so it's appropriate that they've been fired and kicked out of the temple. And I wish them the best of luck, and I think they're a fine example that sane people with something to lose, they need to stand up and risk losing it. And guess what? When you stand up for the truth, sometimes you do lose it. These two lost their jobs. Do I demand that lawyers go in and get them their jobs back? No. You don't want to work there, for crying out loud. Do something else. Start a school of your own. Start a private school. Join a private school. Anyway, let's see here. Eighth graders, listen to this. This is what's really disturbing and scary about the near future. Really, the near future. Listen to this. Why did these two teachers end up on the skyline? Why did they end up getting noticed by the school board that they were involved in this movement? Because eighth graders turned them in. Eighth graders started a petition to get them fired because they were against the queering and the transing and the perversion and the molestation. So the children in the school are on the side of the molesters. It's like Stockholm syndrome because an eighth grader doesn't really know much better. So they started a petition to get them fired, and they got enough signatures that they got the board's attention. And one of the eighth graders behind the petition drive to fire the normal teachers and to side with their molesters said, quote, "When I heard about it, this movement, iResolve, it was just so shocking to me, and I couldn't believe that this was like the world that I was living in." Note to eighth grader, this isn't like the world you're living in. This is the world you're living in. A world where people who say that men should go to the men's room and women should go to the women's room, those people are insane. Those people are oppressors because they want men to use the men's room. Okay? They want he to be called he and she to be called she. That means they're white supremacist oppressors. And you know what? Today we'll fire them. Tomorrow we will shoot them. These eighth graders, 10 years from now, they will shoot in the back of the head, these teachers. Mark my words. Without some dramatic change, these eighth graders right now will carry out the next great genocide. right, we're back. It's the Weekly Worldview. It's the Weekly Worldview. I remember back in 2018, I think, or whenever AOC first ran for the Congress, I think it was 18. Anyway, she said we only had 12 years left, remember? Till the end of the world. So that would mean now we've got 9 years left until the end of the world. And, you know, it could be a self-fulfilling prophecy that has nothing to do with climate. It has to do with the global Marxist insurrection imploding upon itself and devouring the world. That's what it might have to do with. You know, she could end up being correct, at least about the timing of the end of the world. At least the end of the world as we know it. And from there we go into the insurrection file. What, should I go there? No, wait, no. Not there. First, into the decline and fall file, where we go to South Africa, where whether or not you've been hearing about this in the mainstream media, South Africa is descending into chaos, death, destruction, and civil war. The social and economic collapse of South Africa has been escalating over the past couple of weeks. That's according to AmericanConservativeMovement.com, one of the few outlets willing to talk about the fact that South Africa is degenerating into a genocide. That's what's happening in South Africa right now. We reported last week that South Africa is the first state founded upon the principles of critical race theory, and it's ending catastrophically and badly. And the AmericanConservativeMovement.com reporter says the South African situation is a more exaggerated version of what is happening in America. A preview of future events as the extra financial protections of the U.S. begin to fall away. Yes, we are insulated to a certain degree because we're so rich. So we're not going to descend into barbarism overnight. But descend into barbarism we shall. That's right. We are on the same path that the socialists and the Marxists who founded South Africa are on. The Democrat Party here in the United States, a goodly portion of the Republican Party, about a third of the population are heathen Marxists, socialists, and they will drag us down into the same cesspool that South Africa is descending into right now, but with very little. Remember when South Africa was founded, when Nelson Mandela was elected president? The whole world focused on South Africa and how great it was. Now that they're butchering one another in the streets and robbing and looting and burning and killing, the whole world turns away as if nothing's happening. It's shameful. Why do the Marxists want to take us down this path? The American Conservative Movement author implies that it's all about divide and conquer. Divide and conquer. Yeah. Yeah, there's some truth to that. Into the insurrection file. The number of Chicago cops set to retire this year will probably break an all-time record. And cops are now outnumbered by gang members in Chicago by 9-1. Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, and by the way, the Chicago Police Department is reportedly having a hard time with recruiting. Imagine that. Babylon the Great is fallen. You look at Chicago and you think, how could that city ever collapse? Look at it. Look at the skyline. It's incredible. Babylon the Great is fallen. By suicide. All right. We go to the justice file. I should be the injustice file. Where we go to St. Louis, where Circuit Judge Jason Stenghiser, last Wednesday, dismissed first-degree murder charges against Brandon Campbell. Why? Did he find that Brandon Campbell likely didn't commit the murder? No. It was a technicality, you see. No one from the circuit attorney's office showed up to prosecute him. And there were hearings in May, June, and July. And according to rules, if nobody shows up to prosecute for three straight months, the accused criminal is set free. Why? Because the circuit attorney's office can't get their act together enough to prosecute or even make the first step in prosecuting a murder. Anyway, we have Stenghouser had to put out a statement. He didn't want to actually get up on a podium and behind a lectern and answer questions because that would have been really embarrassing. So he just released a statement where he said, in a case like this, where the circuit attorney's office has essentially abandoned its duty to prosecute, the court must impartially enforce the law, and any resultant threat to public safety is the responsibility of the circuit attorney's office. So he's basically blaming the prosecuting attorneys and saying, look, my hands, it says he's like Pontius Pilate. I wash my hands, I'm out. But really, I mean, how accountable is the circuit attorney's office, Judge Stenghouser, Judge Jason? You say they're responsible, but are they accountable in any way for this? No. So it's not reasonable that you allow an accused murderer to go and then you just say, well, it's the law. I have to impartially enforce the law. That's not right, Judge. Because if the people you say are responsible are not accountable in any way, there will be no punishment for them, then you should have ordered the city's attorneys to be arrested. These attorneys who didn't show up, you should have ordered them to be arrested and brought to court to prosecute this case. And you have that authority, Judge. You should have done anything within your power to not let a potential murderer walk the streets. You know, the judges don't understand that their first duty is not to the law. Their first duty is to justice. Their first duty is not to the system. Their first duty is to find what is true and enforce justice. But this judge doesn't even realize that. Anyway, so the circuit attorneys who didn't show up were not arrested and forced to prosecute like they should have been, and this judge could have done that. Instead, a spokeswoman for attorney Kimberly, circuit attorney Kimberly M. Gardner. By the way, Kimberly Gardner is the same prosecutor filing charges against the McCloskeys. Remember the ones who defended their house with the AR-15 in St. Louis as the marchers marched upon their property? This is the same prosecutor's office who's prosecuting them. But she can't get her attorneys to show up for a murder case. They did release a statement. They provided a statement. Upon review of our policies regarding family and, like, medical leave, corrective measures are needed to prevent any repeat of an incident like this. Be assured, I am accountable. And I remain committed to upholding the highest possible standards and practices of accountability at all levels, particularly the public safety of the residents of the city of St. Louis. As a result, the individual in this case is in custody, unquote. So you hear what she says? She says, I am accountable, when she's not. If she was accountable, she would have been fired. She's not accountable. I'm accountable, and I'm accountability, and I uphold the highest possible standards and practices of accountability at all. Okay, lady, that's too many words. You already said I am accountable. That's all you needed to say. The next 45 words were completely unnecessary. You only put them in there because you're lying, and none of us are buying it. And then she lied again. She said the individual in this case, referring to the accused murderer, Brandon Campbell, he is in custody. Well, at the time, at last I was able to research anyway, or at least I know this, at the same time she said this, the police said he's not. They said that Campbell is at large. The same day she said he was in custody, they said he's at large. What will be the consequences for her lies and her incompetence? None. She's not accountable in any way. None of them are. It's not a justice system. It's just a system. And they get by just fine in it. They're doing, you know, they came to do good and they're doing very well indeed, as a matter of fact. All right, we go now to the death penalty file. The death penalty file where Rodney James Alcala, also known as the Dating Game Killer. Yeah, that's right. He appeared on the Dating Game show back in 1978. And then he was arrested and suspected to be linked to dozens of murders in California, Washington, New York, New Hampshire, Wyoming, and Arizona. He was originally sentenced to death in 1980 for murdering 12-year-old Robin Samso in 1979. Rodney James Alcala, the Dating Game Killer, sentenced to death in 1980, died this past week of natural causes at the age of 77. That's just a system. The good news is that James Alcala, the Dating Game Killer, did finally get the death penalty. In fact, he got it Saturday morning. And he met the living God of the universe. And the living God of the universe held him to account for the murder of Robin Samso in 1979. And whoever else this maniac may have murdered. The just a system here on the temporal plane could not figure out what to do with a guy who murdered a little 12-year-old girl and quite possibly murdered dozens of other people. They just couldn't figure out what to do with him. They would convict him and sentence him, and that would get overturned, and then that would get vacated, and they'd try again and again, and they just couldn't figure it out. But God knows exactly what to do with Rodney James Alcala. And in the end, God will do right. And I'm your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back. Thank you. You've made it through two-thirds of the broadcast with nary a mention of the coronavirus or COVID or masks or any of that. That's pretty impressive. But now that's all that's left. Anyway, we go to the widespread immunity file where Sweden's no lockdown strategy can finally be judged. I told you the time would come when the data would say, and we would all know. If we want to know, if there is such a thing as truth still, and there is, then we would know. Well, Sweden followed the policy of dealing with the transmissible virus with a 99% survival rate the way we've always done it. It allowed the population at minimal risk to carry on life as usual and restricted the movements and otherwise protected those who were at elevated risk. By the way, this is always the way we've done it. For always. Well, herd immunity spread in Sweden, and Sweden avoided the catastrophic harm inflicted elsewhere. And now we see that Sweden's approach, which again is how we've always done it, has been vindicated, as you well would have expected, as it is the normal way we did things before we panicked and freaked out. Sweden is now welcoming tourists. Business and schools are opening with little restrictions. And there are no masks. There are no mask mandates. Swedish health officials are not even recommending masks because they think they're dumb. Today, Sweden is freer and healthier than virtually any other nation in Europe. Meanwhile, Australia is locking down again in a panic over the Delta variant. Other nations are panicking over the less lethal variant, hysterically touting the rise in cases, oh no, cases, otherwise known as positive PCR tests. I don't have to get into that. We've already covered that. Most of the new Delta variant cases, by the way, are asymptomatic, which build herd immunity, and nobody gets sick, and very few people go to the hospital, and very few people die, although some people do get sick, and some people die, and some people go to the hospital. I just want to prepare you for this. As we go forward in time, people are going to get sick. Some of them will go to the hospital. Some of them will die. I know it's shocking to think that that could be our future, but it is. Therapies for COVID. This is from the American Thinker, by the way, which I highly recommend. Therapies for COVID, including ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, vitamins, and all kinds of other stuff that we've known for years worked, have become increasingly recognized and used despite the efforts to suppress their use. COVID is the first epidemic in history in which the healthy population was locked down. How that happened is a key question for discussion. Indeed, Sweden's success in using common sense is now vindicated, while those countries that failed to build herd immunity as fast continue to suffer and even redouble their bad bet of locking down. No. Now that I disagree with, Mr. American Thinker. I doubt Sweden has much more or much less than herd immunity than any of the other countries, with or without vaccines. It's just that Sweden has decided not to freak out about what we always know happens with a virus. What happens? They mutate, they become maybe more transmissible, maybe less. But they never become more virulent. They become less virulent. It's just that the rest of the world has decided they're not going to give the people back their liberty. Because once you give your liberty to a tyrant, they generally don't give it back until they die. That's the general rule. Anyway, we didn't delay herd immunity by locking everyone down. We did virtually nothing. Except hand over our liberty to a bunch of technocratic tyrants, heathens, Marxists, godless. Anyway, back to the American Thinker. The leaders who grabbed dictatorial authority, crushed livelihoods, harmed the development of children, violated common sense and historical precedent, have a lot to answer for. Emphasis mine. The very lack of outrage and demands for accountability tells us a lot about the elites that control the institutions of the nations of the world. Well, it also tells us a lot about the people. It also tells us it's not just the institutions who seize the power, it's the cowardly worms who handed it over. You know, the Swedes just never gave in to the delusion that you could stop the spread, slow the spread. And so now they don't feel obligated to continue with it. But the rest of the people who bought into it, which, by the way, is almost every Republican and almost every Democrat and almost every world leader in the world, everyone who bought into it and went along with it, now they're obligated to continue with it. Otherwise, they'd have to stop and say, well, I was wrong. And they're never going to do that. They'll destroy the world, kill everyone and themselves before they'll stop and say, you know what, we made a mistake, we were wrong. On to the Death to Tyrants file, where the Michigan legislature has repealed a 1945 Emergency Powers of the Governor's Act that allowed Gretchen Whitmer to seize the state. She's basically kept Michigan in an indefinite lockdown for over a year and a half. The act had already been declared unconstitutional by the Michigan Supreme Court, but it remained on the books, and so Whitmer just ignored the Supreme Court, kept scaring people, and the cowardly people kept going along with it. Anyway, a group called Unlock Michigan started an initiative, gathered more than 500,000 signatures, brought it to the legislature, and the legislature has finally stripped her of her tyrannical powers. See, they tried it before, but she vetoed it. But when an initiative makes it to the legislature, she can't veto it. So now the people have taken the power away from Gretchen Whitmer. And there's an interesting fellow running, the sheriff of Detroit, or the police chief, I forget. He's an interesting guy. I hope he takes her down. And I hope once he's elected, I hope that she is, I hope she goes down in history as when you look up tyranny in the dictionary or the encyclopedia, if such things even exist anymore, there will be a picture of Gretchen Whitmer and her story of tyranny. And she'll be a byword, and people will despise her. Her family will have to change their name. Meanwhile, from the widespread panic file, let's go back about a week, folks, when the Olympics were first opening up. You remember? Remember, one or two people tested positive. There was his hysterical freak out. Oh, no, we might have to cancel the Olympics because COVID cases. Oh, no. In fact, here's a story from July 20th. Tokyo Olympics are set to start on Friday, and they've had to ban spectators. And the ongoing state of emergency in Japan leads public opinion against the games. So the Japanese cowardly citizens were out in the streets marching with their masks on, saying, "No Olympics, we're scared, go away." That's right, they wanted to cancel the Olympics because they're afraid of getting sick. And so what they did, the Olympic Committee set up what they called an isolation bubble. That's right, we're going to house the athletes in a bubble so that they won't get COVID. And then they kept testing positive. The bubble's been violated, the story goes on. This is from Zero Hedge. Folks, first of all, the idea of a bubble that's anything short of the spacesuits and the sealed rooms that you see in those virology labs, anything short of that is delusional at best and really sociopathic at worst. I mean, literally designed to destroy society. I mean, does the world intend to destroy itself in fear of this virus in perpetuity? Is there nothing that's going to turn this off? I mean, I can't see how this stops. I know I have friends who tell me I'm crazy, that everything's going to be fine. Everything's going in the right direction. Everything's going in the right direction. But to me, it seems like they can't stop. Not that they won't stop, but they have this pathological dedication to not stopping freaking out and being scared. And the news media perpetuates it. They should all be arrested. Every local news mouth that does the coronavirus scare every night, they should all be arrested. And history will look back on them poorly. And you know, the Machiavellians who used the coronavirus to get rid of Donald Trump may not have realized the monumental collateral damage. I mean, who could have known it could have gone this far? I mean, George Soros at his worst and most devious could have never imagined that it could have been this successful from his point of view in taking the legs out of the free market, collapsing the world into chaos and fear, and basically installing the Marxist insurrection as the governing authority of the world. He could have never imagined it would go this far. All right, so from there we go to the brave old hippie file. Brave, I don't know, maybe that's a stretch. Eric Clapton has declared that he will not perform at any venue that requires attendees to prove they are vaccinated against COVID-19, and I'm assuming anything else. He made the announcement one day after UK prime tyrant Boris Johnson, chief hysteric, coward, wuss on a grandest scale ever, a soft, wimpy, not a pimple on Churchill's behind, Boris Johnson. Huh? Not a post-nasal drip. So one day after Boris Johnson said he would mandate full vaccinations for anyone who wants to go to a show, Clapton said, quote, unless there is a provision made for all people to attend, I reserve the right to cancel the show. What? Cancel the show? That would take balls. Are you telling me Eric Clapton's the only one in Great Britain anymore who can still locate his testicles? I mean, that could hurt his career. It could cost him money. Maybe he'll even be sued for canceling the show. And I'll be honest with you, folks. I've always found Eric Clapton to be middling at best. I don't know. I never found him. He's the lowest of all the great British blues guitar players, in my opinion. He's the lowest rung on the ladder. But I got to stand with him on this because he's actually living out what I've been saying for a year at least. I mean, until those of us with something to lose are willing to risk losing it, this will never stop. And Eric Clapton, I mean, what are they going to do to Eric Clapton? Are they going to take away his castle? Huh? They're going to cancel his career? He's like 80 years old. Anyway, he's got very little to lose, but at least he's willing to stand up. Now, here's a guy who's had a lot to lose. Listen to this from the Widespread Panic file. Minnesota Vikings assistant coach Rick Dennison has reportedly quit after he refused to get the experimental COVID vaccine. Yeah, this makes him the first position coach to leave the team, to leave any NFL team because of the vaccine tyranny. They call it vaccine guidelines. The guidelines are get the vaccine or we'll fire you. That's not a guideline. That's tyranny. And this guy stood up to it and he said, you know what? You're going to fire me? I quit. Because there's competing reports in the news whether he quit or whether they fired him. And I'm going to go with him. He quit. So anyway, where are the vaccine guidelines? Yeah. So he's the first coach to leave the team. He got fired or he quit. Oh, no, he lost his job. Oh, no, he'll probably starve to death penniless under a bridge somewhere. You know, that's what happens when you lose a job, right? Well, Rick Dennison, the coach there, he has a bachelor's and a master's degree in civil engineering. So maybe he won't starve to death penniless under a bridge somewhere. Maybe he'll go build a bridge somewhere now that he's no longer a coach in the NFL. Anyway, he's only 63. He's got a lot to lose. He's not Eric Clapton, 80 years old and a bazillionaire. I mean, this guy had a career in front of him in football, and now he no longer does. Guess what? That's not the end of the world. And it's better to stand up for what is right than to go along, to get along, to keep your daily bread. Don't you have any faith in God and what he gave you? That he'll provide you with your daily bread through the brains he gave you and the hands he gave you. And if you rely on him, you don't have to be afraid. And if you die, you win anyway. So why be afraid? All right, from the Widespread Nostalgia file, for those who have nostalgia for justice, Ohio-based attorney Thomas Renz has filed a federal lawsuit on behalf of America's frontline doctors. He filed it in the United States Court for the Northern District of Alabama. The defendant is Javier Becerra, Secretary of HHS. The lawsuit is full of evidence and expert testimony dismantling the so-called emergency. That's right. The emergency was a big fat lie. Now, at the very beginning, I could understand them being able to pass this off because people were genuinely frightened. All right? I can understand. But after, I don't know, May of 2020, it was pretty out. After the Javits Center was empty and the hospital ships, I mean, we could all pretty much see, right, that the emergency was over. Anyway, the lawsuit notes that on February 4th, 2020, HHS Secretary Alex Azar issued the first public health emergency declaration, which has been renewed repeatedly and remains in force today. Azar, by the way, was a big pharma lobbyist before he was appointed to HHS by Donald Trump. That emergency declaration has been used by government to claim legal authority to upend all of our lives and to issue emergency use authorizations for experimental drugs and everything from PCR tests to these new vaccines. The lawsuit states that the legal purpose of an emergency declaration is to bypass checks and balances typically required under law due to a crisis. And then the lawsuit goes on to assert that the crisis never happened. To continue the emergency use authorizations, the emergency use authorizations, the DHHS must meet criteria which the lawsuit alleges it has not. The emergency declaration, says the lawsuit, and its multiple renewals are illegal, since in fact there is no underlying emergency. SARS-CoV-2 has a survival rate of 99.97% for persons under the age of 70, on par with the seasonal flu. So that's it. They're nostalgic for reason. They're nostalgic for justice. These are these lawyers filing this lawsuit are to be commended for reminding us of a time when there might have been reason and there might have been justice. I hope they're reminding us of that can help to somehow lead us back to that, because I'm afraid that we're beyond that, that we're beyond reason and that we're beyond justice. I take this. The headline on CNN, ending mask rule on planes would kill people. This is by Kent Sepkowitz. Did I say Schlepkowitz? Here's what he says. Over the last 18 months, the story of the pandemic in the United States has steadily evolved from rising terror as the virus took hold to a long winter of anguish and then to profound relief as scientific triumph vaccines, yay, arrived and they did their job amazingly well. But then the story shifted again, darkly, as the Delta variant thwarted our happy ending, largely because of vaccine refuseniks in about a third of the country. We are stuck. We are unable to escape. Folks, it's Public Health 101. Data demonstrates that there's risk when using public transportation, and data supports masks. The most compelling and thorough study on this was published a year ago. Okay, we'll stop right there. Published a year ago, huh? Okay, so let's just forget the 100 years prior, and let's just go with the study published a year ago that says COVID's really bad and we all have to wear masks, especially on the train. Anyway, listen to how this is a potential participant in the next great genocide is Kent Schlepkowitz. He is a potential participant in the next great genocide. Here's what he says. Refusal to be vaccinated is endangering the public. A medical breakthrough. People will not take a medical breakthrough that will save their lives. And this, not the pandemic, is what historians will puzzle over in the decades ahead. Oh, yeah? You want to bet? I have a feeling that what historians will puzzle over is not what you just said, you lisping, pathetic. They'll be puzzling over how did they pull this off? How could this have possibly gone this far? How could it have started this way, and how could it have ever ended up this way? That's what they will be pondering, I can assure you. I don't get things like this wrong because I've been paying attention the whole time, okay? Not just the studies that came out last year, but going all the way back. Anyway, that's it, folks. That's the Weekly Worldview for this week. Thank you for joining us. I want to thank my friends at Real Science Radio and at American Right to Life and at the Personhood Alliance and, of course, my other brother, Daryl, who makes it all happen here in the Weekly Worldview studios. Should the Lord tarry, we will return next week. And until then, may the grace of God go with you. And may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.